Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're back with RCR, Greenwashed with Jaspreet and Don. And about 6 months ago, or even further back, we had Tony Seabrook from the Pastoralist and Graziers Association of West Australia on and talking about the Aboriginal Cultural and Heritage Act. And of course, things have moved on, no doubt, but it's important we keep abreast of what's going on in Western Australia. So we've got Tony back in the house today, and he's going to talk about a lot of issues going on in Western Australia, the prime one being the live export issues. Now, Tony, welcome back to RCR Greenwashed. Great to have you on. I know you've been a busy man putting your crops in and tinder dry. Let's hope they germinate and everything goes from there. But what's the biggest issue facing you guys in West Australia, aside from the shortage of rain in your area?
Well, Don, I'll jump into live export in a moment, but you made a little comment early on about having moved on from the Aboriginal Cultural and Heritage Act and our referendum. We haven't moved on. All those people that were there chiseling and chipping away, they've gone quiet. They've gone underground. And when it comes to The Voice, the two best advocates in Australia, Jacinta Price and Warren Mundine, they had some fabulous solutions to the issues. They've been sidelined because they don't fit into what the bureaucratic concept of the way forward might look like. So we won both of those, but the forces behind that have not backed off for 1 second. They're still pressing ahead, so under the radar, doing what they were hoping to achieve in those two pieces of legislation or referendum. So, but look, I'll go into the live export thing because that's the question you asked me. This state had 38 million sheep in it in the early 90s. We're now down to a bit under 12 million. The flock is shrinking at 100 miles an hour. We've got a federal government that is absolutely bolted down to shutting down the live export trade 2028, but the fizz has gone out of it. People are despair. You know, the sheep industry, I sold a truckload of sheep, although we actually slaughtered 2 days ago. I got $42 a head for them. You can't buy a main course in a restaurant over here for $42. This is farcical. You know, to sell a whole living, breathing sheep in good order for $40, and I pay the freight of $5 to get the abattoir and the commission on top of that, I think we're getting to the point of buying an entree for the value of a sheep.
And so relative to, say, if that was on the live export, what would have that animal sort of bring if it was into that?
When they were seriously competing to buy our sheep, they were able to pay $150 or $60 a head. We've got a really shabby season here. We've got a lot of producers with stock on farm that they cannot get rid of. You can ring up an abattoir and they'll say 5 weeks or 6 weeks. You can't get rid of these things. No farmers have got the feed to carry them. There's been a certain amount of stock being shot on property. We've sent nearly 100,000 sheep a month by truck into the eastern states, and that's made a big difference. It's 500,000 less sheep since Christmas that are gone. The live shipping trade, it's shut down now. We're not allowed to export after May. So there's no live shipping out of state right now. And we've got our Minister Murray Watt over in Canberra standing his ground. We are going to shut down this trade. That bastard is the most unpopular man in Western Australia right now.
And it's like they don't understand economics. If I look at it purely, we can go to the welfare issue in a moment, but you're looking at 1.3 million heads of sheep and cattle in total exported last year, over $1 billion in value. The vast majority of those sheep come from Western Australia. And it says that something like 7,000 to 8,000 people get direct jobs. So what is going to be the impact of that to the economy? Do they have a plan? Because they say they have a $107 million worth of transition plan. Planning. What are they going to do? What does the transition plan involve?
Look, the stupidity in the suggestions of how that money might be spent, and a large part of it has been spent through bureaucracy. This won't hit the ground. This won't make any difference at all. And to encourage more abattoir construction at a time when livestock prices are falling and people are not mating their sheep, and this has happened this year, a lot of people are not mated sheep, you'd be absolutely stupid to start pouring concrete and building an abattoir that may not have any role to play in the future. Live export was a fabulous outlet for us. What the minister's done in shutting it down, if you cut WA clean in half north-south, the north is cattle, all cattle. The dogs have killed all the sheep up north, so there's no sheep up north. The cattle industry down here runs alongside the sheep industry. Almost every single ship heading out of Fremantle towards the Gulf has cattle on board. 7,000, 8,000, 9,000 head of cattle on board alongside the 45,000, 50,000 sheep leaving. So when the sheep boats stop leaving, those cattle don't leave either. This is the most poorly thought out policy, and it's not a policy based on welfare or cruelty or anything like that. It's just purely built on a promise that was made by a government to some very active people in inner city Melbourne or Sydney, perhaps Brisbane, Adelaide. But it's minor lobby groups that have caused this. It's not good policy. It's just politicking.
Even if you look at the welfare side of it, Tony, that to my eye doesn't look too bad. I'm looking at the data from LiveX that captures all of this. So about a decade ago, the fatalities used to be something on the lines of 0.81%, and they have now dropped to 0.05%. The last 2 years have had something like the lowest mortality ever. Less than a quarter of a percent, 0.05% fatalities out of an export of 1.3 million heads of livestock. Where's the problem? I don't see one.
There's no problem. Why we are so utterly incensed is that the RSPCA over here and the government are continually saying because of the appalling outcomes, because of the cruelty, because of the deaths, they're lying. They're just absolutely bald-faced lying. And we had an amazing event here a little while ago. A shipload of sheep heading for Israel got as far as Yemen. It got almost into the Red Sea before it was deemed to be a possible target for the Houthi rebels. And they were not that keen to go into the Red Sea with that shipload of sheep. So it turned around and it came back to Fremantle. Never, ever happened before. We're not allowed to bring sheep back into our country. But special provision was made, and the sheep on that ship were actually unloaded off the ship and taken to a quarantine facility where they sat for over 2 weeks as people tried to work out what to do with the shipment of sheep. Then it was decided they were definitely going to Israel. So they were put back on the same ship, and the journey went across the Indian Ocean, around the Cape of Good Hope, right up the Atlantic, through past Gibraltar, right across the Mediterranean to Israel, gaining weight all the way. They were almost too heavy when they got there. And out of 14,000 sheep, I think 16 perished. Now, this is on farm, these things, for odd reasons, they just die. 16 sheep out of 14,000. But the government doesn't want to talk about that because it doesn't fit the narrative of the horrendous, cruel trade that it's supposed to be.
I mean, you have major indicators that they have, you have indicators of general demeanor of these exports, of these livestock being exported. Every day, for every deck, someone assesses the livestock's body language. And if there's an issue, it is reported right away. How much better can you get here?
As someone said, the safest place any ship can be in the world is on a live export ship. The best place, it's sitting in the shade on a comfortable pad. It's got food at one end of the pen, water at the other. It's in good company. It's being watched by vets. Airflow is being measured. Temperature is being measured. Everything is there. The safest place any ship could ever be is on a live export ship. And here we've got a federal government trying to shut it down for political reasons.
Yeah, and they've sort of convinced the country, although in those leafy suburbs you talk about in the bigger states on the east, bigger cities on the east, that, it's only in May the 1st, 2028, all this will phase in, nothing to see here, no one's spooking the troops before then. And I see in the media over the weekend, Tony, it looks like this legislation to put this in play is going to be enacted within 2 weeks in Canberra. I mean, they have no regard for the well-being, as they all say, of your industry. And I'm detecting that you've got a Minister of Agriculture, or for Agriculture, who's about as good as has been in recent times, where they've convinced everybody else that everything a farmer does is fair game, should be under attack.
And look, that is the real threat that we have here. Now, they promised that they would not shut down the trade in this term of government, but they also said that they wouldn't legislate. Well, the legislation is in our lower house right now. Mm. It was forced into a series of inquiries, which were an absolute sham. There was no intention to change the legislation. It will now be voted on in the lower house, and it will then go to upper house, the Senate. The industry is now going to try and have a Senate inquiry, which will keep this in the media, and it will give us the opportunity to continue to prosecute our case. But one of the things that might amuse you and a lot of producers over there almost spontaneously, a body has been formed over here. Farming families and communities in WA, and their logo is Keep the Sheep. A bit unfortunate because I would have said keep the sheep trade running, but this is the motto and it's being called out loudly in public. Now, almost out of nowhere, a protest was organised and four convoys of vehicles descended on the Perth CBD 3 weeks ago. I was part of one of those groups. It was the atmospherics were unbelievable. The good humour, the good feeling, the resolve, the anger, the commitment was fantastic. And the column I was in was 6 kilometres long. And it approached in one lane. We didn't block the traffic. Traffic flowed, but it was 6 kilometres long. And we aimed for the Perth CBD. And then we met at a place called Mushay, which is just northeast of Perth. There were sausages and a barbecue and speeches and the sense of determination, anger and frustration that was vented there. 1,500 vehicles and over 2,000 small business people were part of that procession into town.
Yeah, and so what was the feeling from the city people? Are they very supportive, lukewarm?
There was tooting and waving and placards of support. For any government to say that the community doesn't support this, the support was overwhelming. You know, we started at 5 a.m, but as we were coming into town, there were kids in pyjamas and mums in pyjamas with cups of coffee waving at us as we went past and tooting their horns. We all came away with a great feeling that the community is with us on this. But it gets even better. Minister Watt did not intend to be forced into a situation of having to have one of these inquiries I was telling him about a bit earlier on. And he was also forced into having to have one over here in the West at an ag college out of town called Muresk. We did it again. You know, well over 2,000 small business people turned up. There were outside screens broadcasting what was going on inside the hall where the inquiry was being held. Once again, very polite, but very determined. One of the dumb questions that the very bolted on left-wing chair of this committee asked was, what are you doing to tell your people how to transition to a world without live export? Now, one of the guys in the room, my God, did he bark up? He absolutely went for this lady. And he said, it's not our role to tell our people. We represent them. We don't tell them what to do. And don't you think that they're dumb redneck farmers. These people are very shrewd and very clever and do not need to be advised by you or by us. The applause ran for nearly 2 or 3 minutes. And I just looked at this lady that had asked the question, a federal member of parliament, and I thought, you must be just so tone deaf if you cannot see what the feeling of the community is over here and you're going to press the program. Well, then you're out of touch with reality.
That's the arrogance that's been going on in our country
that's
as
the
well.
Arrogance.
It's the arrogance. Yep. It's the they're so distanced from reality. And so isn't it great you are with 2,000 or 3,000 people and all the people on the sides are in their pajamas, as you say, having cups of coffee and kids out. They're realists.
They actually know that
an economy has to work the way it works. It'll evolve to whatever it wants to evolve to without government interference and dictates. And they can't trust us, can they? They just can't trust us.
Donna, it's interesting when you talk about governance. We need a government to defend our country and we need a government to pay for police and jails and a whole raft of things. But government now seems to be assuming a role in areas where 30, 40 years ago, we would have said, what the hell are you doing? Why are you even for one moment thinking you need to be in this space? This is a lawful trade and it's not cruel and inhumane. What on earth are they doing here if not just plain bloody politicking?
Yeah, well, just as an aside, we have a guy in New Zealand who's written, he writes under the moniker of Bo Ali. Anyway, he is what I would have deemed a extreme left-winger, basically a communist writer for years. He has written really good stuff recently about the breakdown of governance. And as opposed to management capture is rife. So the bureaucrats have captured everything and the elected people are just puppets to the bureaucrats. And I thought for this guy to write that, I thought, gee, we've come so far.
So far.
And we've got a lot to get back. So did I read that you're also thinking about, descending upon Canberra from the west? Are you going to drive across the Nullarbor?
Well, look, the spontaneity of the protests that have occurred so far has been a clear indication that across the board, farmers are angry, and we're getting huge support from the cattle industry and from growers in the eastern states. I think we just need to watch very carefully how the dynamics play out. And this could be a really good thing to do. What might happen as this legislation goes into the Senate? We've got a lot of good friends in the Senate, and we're lobbying some of the independents there that hold the balance of power. If we can push this piece of legislation into a Senate inquiry, not only will it slow it down, but they will actually have to have an inquiry. They'll have to have a panel of people, and we'll have to attend those meetings. It's all recorded under Hansard, which is our parliamentary recording system. I know that the government don't want that. Minister Watt doesn't want that. But if we can force this to a Senate inquiry, that might be a time to have this happen, because at the moment, everyone in West Australia knows about our issues here, but it's still a little bit quiet. It's not quite on the radar in the eastern states to the extent that we'd like it to be. But it's pretty simple. We need to make them feel that this will do them more harm to pursue the policy than any benefit they'll derive from left-wing activists. That's what we need to do. And the method to achieve that's somewhat complex.
Now, Minister Watt's Live Sheep Export Committee, their webpage says that they have consulted extensively, Tony. They say they've had over 80 meetings with farmer representative organizations, 800 written submissions, over 2,000 attendees one-on-one. How has the consultation been to get to this far? He seems to think he's made himself very accessible.
Hey, you've got to take your ears to a meeting where you're consulting with people. You've got to be prepared to listen. You know, to say he's been consulting, mate, he hasn't been listening. This is the issue, I suppose. And this inquiry that we've just been a part of, they asked for submissions. And my view on this, and I said it loudly at the time, no one's going to read them. No one is going to read it. It'll expend a lot of energy. A lot of good people will do a lot of good work. And in the vain thought that someone will listen to this very clear and strong argument. It was only a matter of days after the inquiry was wound up that he came out with a few minor changes. But if anyone thought the minister was going to read any of those submissions and think, I've done this, this is wrong, I need to change, I'm afraid they're kidding themselves. It was never about that.
Going through the motions of democracy, aren't we? But nothing really. Because out here, Don and I read when we began this show today with the Western Aboriginal Heritage Act, all the papers here were saying it's been repealed. It's been repealed. And yet you tell us, yeah, nothing's changed. And just like
those snippy little bureaucrats are still bashing away to find another way. And to be fair, the Aboriginal communities of Australia are not doing it very well at all. You know, this is not a happy situation over here, and there's no shadow of doubt we need to do something different. But what we've got here, we've got 17 parameters at which we measure how this is developing across the whole community, Aboriginal community. I think 4 of them are in positive, 13 of them are going backwards, which really tells you that we're doing the wrong thing. You know, nearly $40 billion a year, and it's not achieving. But the one thing that people don't want to talk about is the cost to the community of dealing with these issues, the slowing down of projects, the stopping of projects, the unbelievable overlay of all the regulations around Aboriginal culture and heritage. And we've got an area up in the Kimberley, the Fitzroy Basin. There's 15 Sydney Harbour fulls of fresh water run down the Fitzroy River to the ocean every year. The CSIRO have come out with a report about how much water could be taken from that river without having any impact whatsoever on the environment of that river. This area could be an absolute booming place for agriculture and jobs, because the one thing that doesn't exist up in north in the Kimberley are jobs. And yet we've got a government so committed to culture and heritage that it's highly unlikely that we'll ever develop that. But you know, for Aboriginal people, we absolutely need to have jobs that are in the places where they want to live. And it's such a backward step to be so-called helping them when you're hurting them.
Yeah, and I note one of your ministers, I forget which one it was, it was probably Tania Plibersek, was talking about nature credits and biodiversity credits as the way forward for the Aboriginal sort of community, where they can trade their land and their credits. And of course, someone will buy them, won't they?
John, the frightening thing here is that we've been through this land rights thing, land rights, and now we're hearing the word traditional owner. Might be mine or something, or Joe Bloggs down there, but there's a traditional owner. So we've got to the land rights position, but now the new one is water rights. They have water rights, and these will be monetized. And so when someone wants to use the water, they'll have to negotiate a deal. And you're not dealing with the Aboriginal people on the ground. You're not dealing with the local communities. You're dealing with some very sharp operators out of law firms in the capital cities who have read the legislation and worked out how they can build the system to get a huge amount of money. And it's just the corporations that will derive the money, the Aboriginal corporations. I'm told there's huge amounts of money embedded there, and it's not helping the people it's supposed to be helping.
I think that would be argued similarly in New Zealand. We have a certain elite that seem to be getting their hands on the gold and the cream at the top. And so, you know, when we get to that point, we've just had a report come out last week. It's called the Agribusiness Agenda. It's written by a big accountancy firm. Its lingo is all in sync with globalist agendas, which, you know, I was cynical about 10 years ago. I'm not so cynical about now. And you see how they've played these cards. You know, let's empower the disadvantaged. Let's trade your property right for something that might have been traditional and before you. So going back to water, this is a question I put in my little email to you, was how do you protect your, or what are your water rights systems like in your area? Do you have access to long-term water, or is it traded easily, or how does it work?
Look, it's in its genesis right now, but we have a grave fear that we are going to lose an awful lot of what we just thought was our right. The consultation process, the permits, the structures involved. I think if you went back 20 years ago and explained to people where we are today, they'd have said, no, that can't possibly happen. It just can't. But one of the things that's quite interesting, Don, is there's the woggle. This is the mythical river serpent that's supposed to reside in all the watercourses around the country. Now, there's a farmer not far from here who's in a world of pain right now, and he's been taken to court because he built a culvert over a little saline creek that runs for a part of the year on his own freehold land from his front gate to where he's living. This is not a major structure. This is just a few pipes in the ground and an access way that keeps his vehicles dry. Now, he has intersected against a piece of legislation that's never been used, but it's been around for quite a long time, and it's turning into a bit of a test case. Now, I really feel for this guy because he's now in his fifth adjournment. The judge would not hand down the decision on the day. This is many months ago. It's been adjourned again. It's supposed to be tomorrow, but it's been adjourned again. We're all watching what might happen. But I sat in the courtroom as Christian Porter, a federal attorney general, but now back practicing law, defended the case. And he asked the question, where does the woggle reside? And he said, if we accept that it lives in the major watercourses here, let's accept that. Up how many gullies and how far up those gullies does this woggle, this mythical woggle, exist? Now, the argument here is everyone has a right to their religion. There's no problem about that whatsoever. We all acknowledge the fact that, you know, people have their religious beliefs and they ought to be allowed to believe in what they believe in. That's theirs. It's their religion. You can't inflict your religion on other people to the extent where you can say to someone, you can't build a culvert over a small creek on your farm, which is freehold land. So, you know, Christian made that point. At the same time this was happening, my youngest grandson came home from school believing in the woggle, the school that told him. And he said, it's a real thing. It's a real thing. How do you explain to a six-year-old boy who's been indoctrinated at school that the teachers are telling him absolute rubbish? You know, he can't go back to his friends there and say, oh, but I don't believe in it, because, you know, it's insidious the way they're doing this. They're quietly selling the story. And I'd say to anyone of Aboriginal descent, you believe in a woggle? Good on you. That's fine. But it's my farm, it's my river or my creek, and I need to do what I need to do with it without you dragging me through the courts of the land. Simple.
Yeah. And that's what, I mean, we've done something similar in New Zealand. In 2017, we became one of the first countries, I believe, in the world to grant the Whanganui River, our third longest, personhood. It was given the legal rights of a person that was an ancestor of the Whanganui Iwi, the Whanganui tribe. Two people were appointed as trustees. $80 million was included in the settlement. Now, today, this example of New Zealand granting personhood is held up as a global example on the World Wellbeing Alliance Forum. So this is you know, you see the same thing happening throughout the West and the East. Even I believe India has also done something similar to one of its rivers. But there it is. It is something today you are making up that this is a person. Then the money changes hands. And
the money changes hands.
Money changes hands. That's probably a common thread in every single one of these. If there was no money changing hand, I can tell you a whole lot of this stuff would just disappear into the ether.
Oh, and the activist lawyers get a chunk of it too, don't they, Jasper? Well, the activist lawyers just milk it.
The Burrup Peninsula up on the northwest coast of Western Australia is a gas hub. It's a mine, iron ore export centre. It is of incredible importance to Western Australia. It's a place where large amounts of wealth are generated. There is some rock art up there, and these areas are held to be of importance. But a little while ago, on a boat out in the middle of a bay, about 40 feet underneath the surface of the water, some divers detected what they thought might have been an Aboriginal campsite. Now, we're talking like 30 feet of water. This is if it ever was there, it was a long, long time ago. Then they brought a rock up from the bottom of the ocean that might have been used as a tool for chipping marks on the stones. And oh my God, what a complication this is causing. And there's just got to be a point where we say to the Aboriginal people, you reckon we invaded the place in January 26th, back in the day? Well, perhaps we did. And we've brought with us a huge benefit to everybody in Australia, including Aboriginal people. Now, you know, if you were invaded, there are things that happen when that happens, and there's give and take here. But you know, this tiny proportion of the population is having an enormous cost impact on every single thing we do in the country, with no recognition of all the good that has come as a result of us being here.
And even then, Tony, it's not like the benefits go to everyone. Just like you say, the Aboriginal are not in a good space. Neither are most of the people who would identify as Maori in New Zealand.
The top,
you know, brass gets it all. And there's enough money. If money was going to solve things, it would have solved it a long time ago. We're the first country in the world that had a tribunal like the Waitangi Tribunal, of which billions has been going through it over decades. And we still think we've not done enough. Now, someone has those billions. There is enough money for enough public housing or free, you know, education, healthcare, everything to be provided if those tribes were looking after their own. But suddenly, after all the reparations given, it is still up to the usual mom and dad taxpayer to take care of certain groups. And why? We no longer now serve people on the basis of their need. We serve them here in the hospital setting because we now have an ethnicity-based healthcare system on the basis of the color of the skin, about how much melanin they have. Or sometimes not even that, because I look at people and I say, all right, you identify as Maori, you could have fooled me. And I'm being very, very un-PC here, but it has to be said. But then I look back, that's what I thought I left behind in India 15 years ago. All this, you know, fighting, our politicians helped us, urged us to fight for religion here. Here it's ethnicity, but it's the same stuff that I thought I left behind, and it's followed me here.
It's still here. It's interesting when I look at the amount of money being spent here, it's close on $40 billion a year on a proportion of the population. If there's 2.5% of our population is Aboriginal, and a lot of them are doing very nicely, thank you. They've got an education, a job, a trade. And so the actual disadvantaged, probably under a million, in some Aboriginal communities, they say that the population of Australia that is actually genuinely Aboriginal is under 500,000 people. These are ones that actually carry a little bit of the culture. It's an industry that just marches on with the acquiescence of the general populace. And to hark back to what you said a moment ago, William Shakespeare, in one of the plays that he wrote, had a great little line there, and it runs along that you might say, "For all the good that thou hast done, get thee gone from here." And that just about sums it up.
It just about sums it up, all right. It's interesting how the similarities exist in both countries, and it's been a slow, as you used the word insidious, it's an insidious creep into the mainstream. And there's people that are so entitled all of a sudden, as if everything that's around them today is bad and rotten, and that their forebears are owed something from our generation. I mean, I think we've made it good for everybody. It's just they've been convinced that it could be much better if they had their pockets filled.
It's a good distraction, Don. Keeps people in fighting while the agenda is on.
Oh, it does.
The ultimate nightmare for any government would be a united population. Can't have that happen.
So just last thing, Tony, because we had to wrap this, but you talked about water. And in the last week, I've become aware, thanks to Jaspreet's sleuthing, that in Idaho, there's been what is called a curtailment policy enacted where 500,000 hectares of potato growing land, so really good fertile land, has had its water rights curtailed at short notice. And these farmers are likely to be put out of business. They've got their crops in the ground and there's a chance that their water right has been taken from them so they can't irrigate. That's something that I think you will be watching like a hawk. I'm watching it like a hawk here because I sense that's close to coming around New Zealand. Do you have any feeling that could start playing out in your...
Don, there's no doubt whatsoever. Now, sharp lawyers that understand how the Act works will try and monetize anything they possibly can. It'll always be about the money. Always about the money. The environment is important. But just something you said a bit earlier on too, these United Nations protocols and agreements, we signed up to it. Well, then unsigned from it. The United Nations is not our government and our country. Unsigned, because the people behind this, the globalists, the people behind this have a different agenda. And while you're kowtowing and bending to the United Nations, no, we are Australia. And especially on the emissions issue that we're dealing with here, we're about to come under sustained attack over our emissions and having to become greener than green, zero emissions by 2040 or 50. And I just say to people about agriculture, I'm doing a presentation at University of WA in a few weeks, and I'm going to say that when the rest of the community gets really serious, when the cruise liners stop, when the aeroplanes that are flying in the sky stop, when nighttime football with all the lights blazing stops, when the community gets serious, then come and talk to us. But stop giving our farmers a belting, because we are the ones that feed you. We feed you.
Wow. Fantastic. I love the spirit that Tony exudes here. I mean, it's something that's missing in New Zealand farm leadership at the moment, isn't it, Jaspreet? It's just a breath of fresh air to hear from you, Tony. Thank you so much for coming back on RCR Greenwashed. Love that. Love the update from Western Australia, and we hope to have you back on very soon. Thank you for...
Look forward to coming back on every time. Jaspreet, good stuff.
See you, Tony. Bye-bye.
See you then. Bye.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.